Let's get back to the digital invasion. If you remember a couple weeks ago, we started into this series, and I talked some about the importance of meditation and how the digital world really goes against the idea of meditation and really hinders our ability to meditate and to find any quiet time alone. We talked about the need of resting the brain and resting the body as well. And I also talked about multitasking and how the world thinks that this is the best thing since sliced bread, and yet the scripture and just reason would tell you that it's not an efficient way of doing things. I wanted to cover the need for human connection last time. I didn't get to that, so we'll start with that this morning. And the outline that I emailed you, we may not get the whole way through. I don't know. I'll see. There's a lot of material here, and I don't want to flood you with it. So, the new digital world that we live in, with social networking and email and text and all these things, they boast themselves a utopia for human connection, right? I mean, we're now more connected with anybody, with people, than we ever have been, right? We can connect with long-lost relatives and friends and family members, old coworkers, everybody. And you would think that we're now, you know, more social than we've ever been because we know more people and we keep in constant contact with more people. But is that really the case? Do you really think that all of this social media stuff has made us in closer relationships with people or not? You have a lot of quantity, but do you have any quality? I would say not really, not very much. People now have hundreds of friends on Facebook and LinkedIn, you know, as if you really have friends. You really think that these people are your friends. Try calling them up one night whenever your car breaks down. Facebook them. Give them a Facebook post when your car breaks down in the middle of nowhere. See how many of them will come and pick you up. That's a real friend. See if your Facebook friends will do that. But do you really think that this digital connection, has it actually improved our relationships and fullness as individuals? Or has it negated it? Has it taken away from it? I don't know. I have some things to say about that, and I'll let you decide whether you think that your modern digital age has made your life better as far as social interaction or not. The scripture emphasizes the importance of face-to-face interaction. And that's why I read from 2 John at the call to worship this morning. The scripture actually has a lot to say about this. I have probably half the sermon devoted to this whole idea of the need for human face-to-face interaction. If you turn to 2 John 1 and verse 12, here, as we read this morning, the Apostle John was writing to this elect lady, and he had a lot more to say to her, and he needed to say more things to her, but rather than continue to write the letter, he waited until he could speak it face to face. In 2 John 1 and verse 12, it says, "Having many things to write unto you, I will not write with paper and ink, but I trust to come unto you and speak face to face, that our joy may be full." Now, you see there, right, included in that verse is the reason why he waited to speak it face to face, that our joy may be full. Doesn't it bring you more joy and happiness to speak to somebody face to face than it does in a letter or in an email or a text? Of course it does. There's just something about seeing somebody in real life, face to face. Sometimes it's harder to talk to people that way. It's easier to talk to them on the phone. You know, it's less personal. You know, you can say, or especially on the internet, you can say all kinds of things. You know, you're 6 foot tall and bulletproof whenever you're behind the computer screen. You wouldn't say things like that in person. So sometimes people like that kind of thing. They hide behind it. But John waited to do it face to face. Even the whole FaceTime thing. And I like FaceTime, and that's probably, as far as our technology has gone, that's as close to face-to-face real-life interaction as you can get. They may have holograms someday, who knows. But even that is not the same. I talk to Pastor Mott on FaceTime all the time, and I like it. It's nice to get to see his face, but it's not the same. We may be the same physical distance apart from my face to his face, but it's not the same, as all of you know. It's just not the same. John also said the same thing in 3 John. He was writing to a man named Gaius. Once again, had more things to say to him, but instead of continuing to write, he was going to wait to see him face to face. 3 John 1, verses 13 and 14. He says, "I had many things to write, but I will not with ink and pen write unto thee. But I trust I shall shortly see thee, and we shall speak face to face. Peace be to thee. Our friends salute thee. Greet the friends by name. He wanted to wait to see him face to face. And, you know, back in those days, that might have been a while till he could see him face to face too. It wasn't like it was where you just hop in the car and take 5 minutes and drive over to see him. You're writing a letter back then, he might not have gotten it for weeks, and then John may not see the guy again for quite some time. If he's writing a letter that's going to take that long to get to him, I assume that he didn't live next door where John could see him. But some things are worth waiting for. Some things are worth waiting to tell somebody until you can do it face to face. When I had to talk to some of you about what happened here last week, as many as I could, I wanted to do it face to face. I was able to do that with some of you. Most of the rest of you, I at least did it on the phone. I wanted to make it as personal as I could and explain these things to you person to person rather than just sending out a blanket email. Sometimes, you know, if you have a church of 100 people, you're going to have to email in that case. But if I can, I like to make it as personal as I can. Though far more personal than email or text or Facebook, even handwritten letters are no substitute for face-to-face communication. Think about how neat it is these days to get a handwritten letter. I mean, that's pretty special. I think so, at least. When I get a handwritten letter, there's just something about that. The paper, the actual, that person actually wrote on that same piece of paper, and some other person carried it to me from a long ways away. And there's just something real about that. There's something really neat about that. And that's far better than Facebook or text or emails. But even handwritten letters are no comparison for face-to-face. Try giving somebody a hug with a letter. You can't do it. It's totally different. Try being married. Try having a long-distance marriage for your whole life where you write each other letters. See what kind of a marriage that's going to be. Obviously, that would never work. Jesus' disciples had sorrow when they were told that they would see him no more. But when they would see him again, their hearts would rejoice. See how the Word of God upholds this idea of the importance of seeing each other. Look at John 16, 17 through 22. John 16, 17 and 22. Then said some of his disciples among themselves, "What is this that he saith unto us? A little while, and ye shall not see me, and again a little while, and ye shall see me, and because I go to the Father." So Jesus had warned them, "You're not going to see me after a while. I'm going to go to the Father, and then you'll see me again, but it'll be a while." Well, this made them sorrowful in verse 22. And Jesus said, "And ye now therefore have sorrow, but I will see you again, and your heart shall rejoice, and your joy no man taketh from you." So we all know what it's like whenever we have to say goodbye to somebody and you can't see them face to face. When I left and went overseas for a year, oh yeah, I could still write. I could write, I could email, I could do all that stuff. It's not the same. It's not the same. You're gone that long. That's something that definitely brings us sorrow. While writing to Timothy a letter, Paul told him that he greatly desired to see him. Look at 2 Timothy 1 and verse 4. You can form your own opinion on all this stuff, but I can tell you what God's opinion is. God's opinion is he likes people to see each other in person for real. That's what God likes. 2 Timothy 1, 4, Paul says, "Greatly desiring to see thee, being mindful of thy tears, that I may be filled with joy." It was gonna make Paul very happy to see Timothy. See him face to face. The letter just wasn't gonna suffice. Paul, writing to the Romans, said that he longed to see them. And why? So that they could be comforted together between the two of them. Look at Romans 1 and verse 11. He says, "For I long to see you, that I may impart unto you some spiritual gift to the end ye may be established. That is, that I may be comforted together with you by the mutual faith both of you and me." And isn't that what the church is all about? That we comfort each other with the mutual faith of each other. Can you imagine what our church would be like if everybody sat at home and got on Skype and got a group Skype, and I preached, and everyone individually was off by themselves? What kind of a church would that be? It wouldn't be. I would never pastor a church like that. Never. Wouldn't even consider it. There's just certain things that technology can't replace. And one of them is face-to-face communication. Paul and Timothy and Silas, or Silvanus, greatly desired to see the faces of the Thessalonians in 1 Thessalonians 2 and verse 17. I've probably made the point by now, but I have more for you. I want to pile as much up on here as I can to show you the importance of this. 1 Thessalonians 2 and verse 17 says, "But we, brethren, being taken from you for a short time in presence, not in heart, endeavored the more abundantly to see your face with great desire." You know, the Bible does affirm the fact that we can be together in spirit, not physically. But is that a replacement for being together physically? "Oh, I didn't come to church today. I wanted to go golfing, but I'm with you in spirit, brother." Yeah, right. Show me you're with me in spirit. Get your butt in the door, unless you have a good reason to not be here. I'm not saying we can't miss church. I've done it myself, and I'm not saying that. But if we can, we should be here. We should want to be here. They likewise, that is, the Thessalonians likewise, greatly desired to see them. It wasn't just a one-way thing. Paul just didn't want to see them so he could check up on them and make sure they were doing everything right. He wanted to see them, and they wanted to see him. That's a good pastor-church relationship right there. 1 Thessalonians 3:6. "But now when Timotheus came from you unto us and brought us good tidings of your faith and charity, and that ye have good remembrance of us always, desiring greatly to see us, as we also to see you. Therefore, brethren, we were comforted over you in all our affliction and distress by your faith." And that's something that really brings a pastor comfort. When I know that you, when I come back from a trip and you all are happy to see me, that makes me happy. And I'm happy to see you too, and I hope that makes you happy. I mean, that's really something. That's quite a blessing. You know, back in those days, I mean, Paul had to send somebody. If he wanted to find out how they were, there's no calling them up on the phone. He had to send somebody, and Timothy had to go and then relay the message back to him. Just to, "Hey, everything's good here. You know, they're continuing the faith. They really want to see you and everything." And so it was different in those days. We take all that for granted now. We have no idea what it would be like without telephones and internet and all that stuff. Quite different. Paul prayed night and day that he would see their face. Look at verse 10. 1 Thessalonians 3:10. "Night and day praying exceedingly that we might see your face and might perfect that which is lacking in your faith." That's one reason why I wanted to go visit the non-resident members. It's just good to see people. And I see them up here. But it's good to see people in their own element, to see them where they are. You really get to know people a lot better, and you get an idea of their situation that they're in. It was good. I'm glad that I was able to do that. It's important. Why not just write a letter, Paul? Well, wouldn't be the same, would it? "The elders at Ephesus wept sore and sorrowed that they would see his face no more." Acts 20, 37 through 38. Here in Acts 20, Paul was giving his final words of exhortation to these elders, I assume many of which he ordained in this church in Ephesus. It's interesting, the church in Ephesus started out, I think, with 12 people. And by this time, he's speaking to the elders at Ephesus. So the church had grown from 12 people to having a multitude of elders. So there's hope, brethren. There's hope for our church. Acts 20, 37 through 38. It says, And they all wept sore and fell on Paul's neck and kissed him, sorrowing most of all for the words which he spake, that they should see his face no more, and they accompanied him unto the ship. Here are grown men, ordained ministers of the gospel, weeping, crying, because they're not going to see Paul's face anymore. There's nothing wrong with grown men crying. There's nothing wrong with crying when you're not going to see somebody anymore. When I gave my farewell address to the Cincinnati church, the last part of it was this text here, when it said that he went and he kneeled down with them and prayed. And I prayed, and then I read that they wept sore, that they weren't going to see his face anymore, and they accompanied him to the ship. And I said, all right, accompany me to Williamsburg, and let's get that U-Haul packed up. And everybody laughed, of course. But, yeah, it's there's just something about not seeing him anymore. Maybe they got letters. I don't know if this was before or after Paul had written the letter to the Ephesians. I'm not sure. I'd have to look at that. So they may have gotten an epistle from him, but it wasn't the same as seeing his face. We all long to be with Jesus so that we can see his face. I think I speak for you all. I know I speak for myself. That's what the thing that I look forward most of all to going to heaven is, to see his face, to see God's face in the face of Jesus Christ. And I'm thankful that you picked that second hymn. That was good. I don't remember what it was now, but I remember thinking at the time that was good. Anyway.
Glory, oh, glory to be.
Yes. Oh, when by his grace I shall look on his face. Yes, thank you. Maybe we can sing, what was the other one? I had another one picked out. Oh, I want to see him. Yeah, yeah. That would be good after this service. 1 John 3 and verse 2. You know, the letter's great. We got lots of letters from Jesus here in this Bible, and that's good. And we have a great blessing in that. But boy, I can't wait to see him. 1 John 3 and verse 2. Beloved, now are we the sons of God, and it doth not yet appear what we shall be. But we know that when he shall appear, we shall be like him, for we shall see him as he is. Scripture says that no man hath seen God and lived. But when we get the new bodies, the flesh and, you know, it says flesh and blood cannot inherit the kingdom of God. But when we get that change and we get those new spiritual bodies, we will be able to see God face to face. Maybe after we get up off of our knees having our face on the ground for a couple hundred thousand years, then we'll be able to see him face to face. You know, you see, whenever the prophets saw God, their face was on the ground. These clowns that tell us nowadays, oh, I had this vision and I saw God, they don't talk about that kind of stuff. Oh, it was great. I was so happy. It was just neat. I said, hey, how are you, girl? What are you? I'm kind of making fun of them, but it's just nonsense. A lot of these heaven sightings are, you know, where these... I don't buy it. Honestly, I don't think I buy it. The people die, go to heaven and come back and all this stuff. And I think it'd be interesting to ask them what Jesus looked like and see if they sketch out the long-haired, you know,
right,
hippie-looking guy.
Right.
Then you know they're definitely lying. But anyway, I just don't. I don't really buy into that stuff. Look at Revelation 22, 3 through 4. It sells a lot of books, though. It makes a lot of people a lot of money. Revelation 22, 3 through 4. I saw this little boy, an interview with this little boy that supposedly died, went to heaven and came back. His dad's a preacher, and they were on the Today Show or something and promoting this thing. They'd written a book, and they asked him, well, you know, what was it like up there? And he's like, well, I don't really remember. It was a long time ago. And you don't remember. Oh, there was a lot of colors. I'm like, how can you not remember? I mean, you saw heaven, supposedly, and you don't really remember I don't know. Sounded like nonsense to me. Revelation 22, 3 through 4. It says, and there shall be no more curse, but the throne of God and of the Lamb shall be in it, and his servants shall serve him, and they shall see his face, and his name shall be in their foreheads. That's the promise of heaven. We will see God's face. It's especially important for church members to see each other as often as possible. It's important for human beings to see each other and have social interaction, but it's really important for church members to see each other, to spend time physically together. Back there in the Old Testament, it was said of the Old Testament saints that they spake often one to another. In Malachi 3, verse 16, this is the last book of the Old Testament. Just start in the beginning of the New Testament and go back a couple of pages and you'll find it. Malachi 3, 16. It says, then they that feared the Lord spake often one to another, and the Lord hearkened and heard it. And a book of remembrance was written before him for them that feared the Lord and that thought upon his name. God wrote a book of remembrance for them that feared the Lord, thought upon his name. They spake often one to another. They didn't write or email or text or Facebook or anything else. They didn't do that often, but they spake often one to another. And in those days, what does that mean? When you spoke to somebody in those days, that means you're face to face. There was no speaking to people if you weren't within, well, earshot of them anyway. So that is an example of people meeting regularly, seeing each other, getting together regularly. This is why it's important for all church members, both resident and non-resident, to be in attendance as often as they can. It's important for us to see each other, especially for the non-residents, because they don't see us very often. It's important to make these trips up here and to see each other and to spend time. The non-resident members should try to work their way around whenever they come up here. Austin just mentioned this to me, and get to know other people that they don't know as well, that they haven't, maybe, you know, new church member they haven't even met before. It's important to get to know each other. And to do that, when I was a non-resident member back in Cincinnati, I was able to go down quite frequently given my situation, and I stayed in people's houses. I would pick a different family every time I would come down. And over the course of that year and a half, I was able to stay with, I think, just about every family more than once in their homes and really get to know people. That's a blessing. That's one of the blessings of non-resident membership that resident members don't have. How often do we stay at each other's houses for a weekend? Never. You know, how often would you want to stay at each other's houses for the weekend? Everybody's laughing and shaking their heads. But I enjoyed coming up here, you know, before I was the pastor and staying. I stayed with you guys lots of times. And I appreciated that. I got to get to know you. Gave me second thoughts about coming up here, but anyway. Christians are to be our companions. Look at Psalm 119 and verse 63. Psalm 119 and verse 63. The psalmist here says, I am a companion of all them that fear thee and of them that keep thy precepts. Those ought to be your best friends. The people that fear the Lord, fellow Christians, they ought to be your companions. They ought to be the ones that you spend time with. But all too often, that's not the case. All too often, our best friends, the people that we spend time with the most, are not church members. You know, there are people of this world who are anything but a good influence on us. Evil communication corrupts good manners. He that walketh with wise men shall be wise, but a companion of fools shall be destroyed, Proverbs tells us. A companion is one who associates with or accompanies another, a mate, a fellow. And to associate, in that a companion is one who associates with another, to associate is to join persons or one person with another in common purpose, action, or condition, to link together, unite, combine, ally, confederate. So when you're a companion, you're linked together. You're linked together for a common purpose. And that's the great thing about church brethren. Whenever you are a companion of church brethren, you know you have a common purpose. You may not agree on all kinds of other stuff in the world, but you know at least one thing, serving Jesus Christ, you have a common purpose. And it breaks down other barriers where you can have a good, close friendship. I notice this with people out there in the world, even people that I have other similar interests with, and I don't have similar interests in the faith with, it's never the same. It's just not quite the same. But with church people, people that are of like faith, even if I've never met them before, I can go to the Detroit church and meet somebody there I've never met before, and I can talk to them for an hour, and I've done it. I've met people there that I didn't even know before and felt like I'd known them half my life. How does that work? Well, it's because it says that we're baptized into one body by one spirit, made to drink into one spirit. Even if we're not members of the same church, we're still members of the same type of church. And we're all members of that universal church of Christ. And I'm not talking about Roman Catholicism either, just in case you're confused. To accompany is to accompany a person or thing to. Now, I think that's breaking a fundamental rule of dictionary defining there, to define a word with the word. To accompany is to accompany. Anyway, to accompany a person or thing to another, to add as companion, to associate, to join, or conjoin to. So when one is a companion with another, they are joined together. That's my whole purpose. If you're a companion with all them that fear thee, as the psalmist says, it means you're joined. You're linked together. Not linked in, but joined and linked together, physically, spiritually. Now consider the following observations from the digital invasion. regarding the drawbacks and dangers of digital connections. I got some good quotes for you here. It says, digital contacts can never compensate for real face-to-face human human contact with those you love. The concern is this detachment's impact on how parents attach to children and in turn affect the attachment style they will develop. We are designed for real-life attachments where we are seen, valued, and heard. It is in our closest relationships that we experience this. If our brain system becomes more attached to digital gadgets and detached from people, our relational skills will atrophy. We are already seeing evidence of this. So it's important to have face-to-face real relationships with people for the sake of your kids too, because your kids are going to follow what you do. They're going to see how you relate to other people and how you relate to them, and then that's how they're going to relate to other people, and that's how they'll relate to their kids. So it's important to set a good example for your kids and to lead by the example. Have face-to-face communication with your kids. Talk to your kids. Know your kids. You know, don't let your relationship be with your kids over Facebook. That's not going to work. Because all they know is what they've seen and what they've been taught. And if they haven't experienced real relationships, real love, real connection in the family, what do you think their families are going to be like? And it'll probably be worse because they don't even have an example to follow. It says, research shows that human connection is one of the keys to happiness. Connections are what make us human and are the core of how we express our humanity. He's right. If you think about it, human beings are designed to be among other people. We're designed to be in relationships. God designed most people anyway to be married, to be joined intimately with another person. And that's why we have families. We're not like animals that, you know, they don't have marriages. They have families, and as soon as the kids are old enough to walk and be on their own, they're gone. And as far as I know, they don't have any familial connection at all. And I don't know if animals have friends or not, but not like people anyway, for sure. Well, I mean, it's clear, anybody. I mean, you don't even have to have a brain. Just look around and observe. You can tell that human beings are designed for this close, intimate connection. And to not have that would be to cease to be human or to be less human. You're not fulfilling God's design for your life. So the idea of somebody being a monk or going to live in a monastery, that is not scriptural. That's not how God has designed us. Oh, I'm so holy, I just can't be around other people, and I just want to devote myself entirely to God. That's not right. We're supposed to, especially ministers, they're to give themselves wholly to these things, but we're also supposed to be out among people, and we're supposed to have connections with other people. So I'm preaching to myself because I can spend a lot of time in that apartment by myself. But it's important for me to get out there and be among people as well. It says, unfortunately, the digital social media that now dominates our lives tends to foster more self-centeredness than deeper connections. Think about it. Does Facebook, if you had to take a guess, take a vote, does Facebook make somebody more connected, more have closer, healthy relationships, or does it make somebody more interested in themselves, promoting themselves, self-centered, and so on? Just think about it. Look at most people's Facebook pages, and I have more to say about this. It's all about promoting the self. You know, YouTube, broadcast yourself. I have a YouTube channel, everybody knows that, but you've seen my channel. What my channel is for is to propagate information to get people interested in the truth. That's what my YouTube channel is for. And occasionally I have something funny on there or whatever. But generally, it's just to get the truth out there. It's not something to promote myself. I just had somebody, some feminist, say that I was a male chauvinist on there. And I looked at her page. The funny thing is, her page, when you go to her page, a video will start automatically playing. I think I have mine set up that way too. It was just a picture video of herself. It wasn't even her with her family or friends or boyfriend. It was just herself, just picture after picture, played the music. I'm like, wow, I mean, you talk about a narcissist. My goodness. So anyway, I didn't watch the whole thing, but the first, I don't know, 10 seconds of it anyway, was nothing but pictures of her. I didn't reply to her comment, in case you wondered. Okay. Continuing on here, another quote. A good rule of thumb for yourself. This is very important. Listen to this. A good rule of thumb for yourself and to teach your children is to use the digital world to relay necessary information, but communicate deeper thoughts and emotions in direct face-to-face encounters. This is essential in today's digital world for laying the foundation of healthy connections and relationships. And I think that is such a powerful point. We cannot go out of this world entirely. We cannot cease to use the internet, use telephones and all that kind of thing. We're pretty much stuck using this stuff to a certain extent. So use it to communicate necessary information. But if you need to communicate something serious to somebody, to communicate deeper thoughts or emotions to them, do it face to face. If you have a problem with somebody, if you need to confront somebody, a friend or a church member or a family member or whoever, don't do it over the internet or don't even call them up. If you can, if it's possible, do it face to face. There's so much lost in communication that is not where you can't actually see the other person. I don't know what the percentage is, but it's a large percentage of communication is nonverbal. It's the look in the eye. It's the tone of the voice. There's a lot of things that can't be said in words, and especially typed in words. You can't convey them properly. I mean, I've literally talked to people. I just had this experience the other day. I was talking to this person about doctrine, and I could just the look on his face said all that needed to be said. I knew exactly what he was thinking. He was thinking, you know what, you're right, but I just can't accept that. And then about 5 minutes later, he said, not even 5 seconds later, he said, you know, you're right, but I don't like who that makes God to be. He didn't even have to tell me that. The look in his eyes and on his face, I could tell exactly what he was thinking. That wouldn't have happened on the phone. And if he wouldn't have said anything to me, I would have had no idea what he thought. Totally different. So communicate just necessary things. Hey, I will be over for dinner at 6 o'clock tonight. You don't have to do that face to face. But when you want to talk to your child or something about a problem in their life or something serious in their life, do it face to face. He continues here. Media has put us close to the people who are far away, but has separated us from the ones who are nearby. Isn't that true? We're close to those who are on the other side of the country, the other side of the world. We're Facebook friends or whatever. Do you know your neighbor? Let me turn around. Do I know my neighbor? I know one. In a year here, I know a couple. I guess I know a couple people in my building, but I don't hardly know any of my neighbors. I don't know. It's probably as much my fault as it is theirs, but people just around here aren't too friendly. And if you're not the most outgoing, extroverted person, and I'm not, I don't know too many people. And, you know, hopefully over the course of time, I will get to know more people. But anyway, one of the reasons is people are looking at their phones all the time. Nobody talks. I have more to say about that later. As one expert puts it, tech savvy our children are. Life savvy they are not. Children who socialize mainly via social media do not grasp the finer points of social interaction. They need human contact, coaching, and modeling. There's a lot more to communication than just typing words on a computer screen. And the kids need to learn that. They need to learn how to talk to somebody. I think two important things that'll take you far in life are very simple. A good firm handshake and eye contact when you talk to somebody. Talk to them, look them in the eyes. That's great interviewing techniques. A good firm handshake, a nice smile, and eye contact. You can get just about any job you want. I mean, you could go, your experience could be a burger flipper at McDonald's, and you could probably get a job in rocket science if you had a good handshake, eye contact, and a nice smile. And maybe you could talk some rocket terminology or something and manage to bamboozle them into hiring you. But anyway, I've got into jobs where I thought, oh man, I don't even know if I'm qualified for this thing because you just interview well. So sometimes that can be kind of scary. But anyway, that's important. Teach your kids to look people in the eye. One more quote for you. Current research also reveals that digital natives who spend most of their time in a virtual world will more likely be lonely. You think about, how can you be lonely? I've got 500 friends on Facebook. It's real easy to be lonely. Have you ever been lonely walking through a crowded mall? Walking through a crowded Walmart? I don't think I'm ever more lonely than when I'm around a ton of people in public that I don't know. I think that's the most lonely time there is. Here's a few tips for overcoming loneliness and making real connections and friendships. First of all, if you want to be a friend, you have to be friendly. I'm about ready to get friendly with that fly here if he flies around my face again. Proverbs 18 and verse 24. This is just good common sense, and that's what the Proverbs are, is good common sense. But if you want a friend, you gotta be a friend. It's really that simple. Proverbs 18:24 says, a man that hath friends must show himself friendly, and there is a friend that sticketh closer than a brother. We've all probably experienced that. Friends that are closer to us than our own siblings. I'm close with my brother, and I'm thankful for that. But I'm sure a lot of people have experienced that. Now, this is only true if you're reading a King James Bible. If you're reading an NIV, which something happened to my NIV. So you'll see what I'm talking about. Yeah. So anyway, if you're reading an NIV, instead of it saying a man that hath friends must show himself friendly, it says a man that hath friends comes to ruin. Go figure. Kind of the opposite of what it really says. So anyway, if you want a friend, you got to be a friend. And that means sometimes you got to do things that you might not even want to do. I remember one time a friend called me up and asked me if I wanted to do, I don't know if it was skeet shooting or something on a Saturday morning. And I don't know, I was just tired. I was busy. I really didn't want to. And that verse popped into my head. And I thought, you know what? If you want a friend, you better be a friend. And this was a close friend of mine anyway. I said, yeah, I'll go. Turned out I got rained out anyway. But anyway, you know, just suck it up and do it. Sometimes you have to do things you don't even want to. Go out and you know, just appease your friend and do things that he likes to do that you might not even like to do, just for the sake of the friendship. Same thing with your wife. Your wife's supposed to be your friend. Your husband's supposed to be your friend. Your husbands definitely need to learn that. Do things that your wife likes to do. It'll make your marriage a lot better. Frequent the same places at the same times. This will help you to see the same people regularly, which will help you to naturally establish connections. Back to the lonely, combating loneliness thing. Go to the same places at the same time. And I'm not real good at that yet, but I try to go up here to this caribou sometimes on certain nights. And, you know, maybe, at least you get to know maybe the person working at caribou or something. And maybe there are other people that frequent them at the same times. So, that can help. Visit other people who are lonely, like the elderly. That can really help you. To help somebody else out with the same thing that you're suffering with really can help. If anybody knows of any old folks' homes around here, I would like to start visiting some. I found one and I talked to them, and I think when they found out I was a Baptist preacher and it was a Catholic institution, they all of a sudden didn't have any more need for help. So I don't know if that was just a coincidence or not, but anyway, I feel bad for elderly people that are all by themselves, no family, no friends, and they just sit there all the time by themselves. It's terrible. Join a meetup group and attend regularly. I've done that. It's nice you get to see the same people every, you know, maybe every 2 weeks or once a month or something, and that's a way to build at least some type of acquaintances, associates of some type. Try to at least say hi to people in your proximity. Don't be like all the rest of the drones around here and just walk with your head down all the time. Say hi to people. When I'm walking around, even though it's kind of awkward because nobody else does it, but I at least say hi to people that I walk past, and they generally say hi back if you do that. So you never know when it might spark up some kind of a conversation. And lastly, look up. Stop looking at your phone in public. You might be missing opportunities to have real conversations. There's a great video out there, and it's funny, after I sent it to some people, then about four people sent it to me and said, hey, you need to see this. And it was really going around. But anyway, it's called Look Up. If you haven't seen it, you should do it. Just go to YouTube and YouTube Look Up. It's there are other people that have been making these same observations. But that's one thing I've generally stopped doing, is looking at my phone in public. I used to, you know, I'm walking around the park or sitting anywhere, instead of just looking at my phone, I just look around and look at other people, and, you know, maybe you'll have a chance to talk to somebody. It's one of those things where it doesn't look too bad until you see other people doing it. Like, I could be sitting there looking at my phone, you know, at an airport or wherever, and just, you know, spend an hour just reading some article or whatever. And I think, oh, that doesn't matter. I mean, I'm not here with somebody. It's not like I'm neglecting a friend or somebody. And then I see other people doing it. Look at that guy just sitting there staring at his phone all the time. He's not talking. He's not looking around. I mean, you know, he could get hit by a bus and he wouldn't even know it until after he was dead. And so it just helps sometimes to put the shoe on the other foot, you know, just to look what other people are doing and realize, you know what, I'm doing the same thing. All right, let's talk about the narcissism epidemic. This is a real problem, especially with the social media stuff, Facebook and MySpace and that kind of stuff. LinkedIn is another one. Social networking breeds narcissism. If you don't know what narcissism is, it's defined as self-love and admiration that find emotional satisfaction in self-contemplation. So it's basically a word for pride, and I'll get into that in a second. But that's what narcissism is. It's somebody that's in love with themselves and only interested in themselves. And this type of thing, the social networking, just is a breeding ground for that kind of thing. It's a narcissist dream, and I'm getting ahead of myself. Let me give you a quote here from The Digital Invasion. He talks about this very thing. He said, "This journalist experience also highlights one of the major drawbacks of our overuse of social media, namely that it fosters the growth of narcissism, which is now seen as an epidemic in our young people. Narcissists are preoccupied with themselves and are obsessed with what others think of them. They also believe that they are entitled to the attention of everyone else. Narcissists are not particularly interested in or good at offering warmth and caring in their social interactions. They can enjoy being around people and be most charming, flattering, and likable, but it is all for their own benefit." See, sometimes you think of a narcissist as just this jerk that walks around telling everybody how awesome he is. At least smart narcissists don't do that. They may walk around telling everybody how great they are, but they kind of, you know, couch it in some terms that doesn't make them sound as bad as they are. And they might even act like they're interested in somebody else just to get a chance to promote themselves. You know, if you're just a jerk to everybody, nobody wants to talk to you. If you're kind of nice to people and pretend to be interested in them, then you have a chance to talk about yourself for a while. That's a narcissist for you. One can easily see how Facebook is a narcissist's dream. Think about it. They get to be a star, at least in their own eyes. Look how popular they are, how many likes and how many friends they have on there. They post all the best pictures of themselves. You know, here is an avenue where you can make yourself look way better than you really are. They just love it. They post updates about their every move, as if people actually care what they're doing. Don't you love that? All these stupid posts. I used to read all these dumb posts on Facebook about just dumb things. Oh, I'm sitting here having a coffee. Well, that's wonderful. Thanks for wasting my time making me read that. They get to promote a false image of themselves, which is much more interesting than the real person. I'll tell you, I could do this. I used to do it. I'll fess up to it years ago when I was on Facebook. I could make myself look way more interesting than I am. I mean, I've been around. You know, I've got pictures of me holding machine guns and all this crazy stuff and on convoys and whatever else, and pictures of overseas and at the Neuschwanstein Castle in Germany and in Mexico and Guatemala, all these different places. It looks like you're just this incredible world traveler and you just done all these amazing, cool things. And then you really get to know me and you're like, this guy's like one of the most boring people I've ever met in my life. You know, so I mean, you can really make yourself out to be something you're not just by showing neat pictures of places you've been. And people look at you and think, wow, this guy is just, look at his life. Boy, it must be awesome just to be a world traveler. And then you realize, yeah, he's just a guy. You know, he's no different than anybody else. And so anyway, this is what narcissists do. Do you do it? Ask yourself, do you do it? I have observed narcissistic tendencies in young children as well as in adults. I've seen it in kids. When I worked at that tutoring center, especially younger girls, teenage girls, lower teens, my goodness, you talk about people that are full of themselves and full of pride. It's unbelievable. They'll sit there and tell you, I'm so smart. But I don't know if they're even kidding. I think they really believe it. I had a notion. I wasn't trying to be mean, but I had a notion just to give them a hard math problem and say, how smart are you now? But anyway. It doesn't help when parents are always telling their children how pretty or smart or talented they are. You're not doing your kids any favors. I mean, you know, a compliment that is worthy is okay. I mean, there's nothing wrong with giving compliments, and you should give compliments. That's important. Some parents never give compliments. Nothing their kids can ever do is good enough. But on the other hand, don't always be telling your girls how pretty they are. Don't always be telling your kids how talented they are. You're not helping them out. You're just fueling their pride. One little girl I heard about in another church, everybody would always tell her how cute she is, and her parents were telling her, and then she was telling people that she's cute, and her parents said, you know, you can't say that, you know, let another man praise thee, not thine own mouth, and then she'd tell people that other people say that I'm cute, or something like that. Anyway, it was kind of cute, but it's not cute when you get to be an adult. It's kind of cute when you're a kid and you don't know any better, but. Alright, so narcissism is just a modern word for pride. Pride is the quality of being proud, a high or overweening opinion of one's own qualities, attainments, or estate, which gives rise to a feeling and attitude of superiority over and contempt for others, inordinate self-esteem. So it's not only that you have this great opinion of yourself, but it generally tends to lead you to despising others and thinking that you're better than them. Not only am I so great, but I'm way better than this guy, and I'm better than these other slobs. That's pride. And don't you just love it? We use the word pride today like it's a good thing. I mean, American pride, proud to be an American. You see all the bumper stickers and all the stupid songs and everything. It's absolute nonsense. And I mean, it's just amazing to me that something that the Bible calls wickedness and sin, and which was the first sin in the universe, and I'll get into that, it's something that we boast ourselves of and say how proud we are to be Americans. It's unbelievable. I mean, would you go around boasting? You know, would you have a bumper sticker that says, you know, I, fornicator or adulterer? I mean, you know, but you put a sticker, and I hope none of you have them on your cars, and if you do, take them off before I see them. Proud parent of so-and-so at some honor student at some school. Don't let me see them on your car. Take them off before I see them. I can't stand that crap. Unbelievable. Proud is having or cherishing a high or lofty opinion of oneself, valuing oneself highly on account of one's position, rank, attainment, possessions, etc., usually in a bad sense, disposed to take an attitude of superiority to and contempt for others, arrogant, haughty, overweening, supercilious. Who here knows what supercilious means? It means proud. Come on, guys. How many times? Haven't I done this to you like 3 times now? And you just,
I do it
to be humble. Oh, you're right. There you go. There you go. He's been listening to the sermon. That's good. All right. So, in case you didn't know, pride is a sin. Got some verses here for you. Like I just made mention of a minute ago, pride is the first sin that was ever committed. Even before Adam fell in the garden, somebody sinned a sin of pride. Turn to 1 Timothy 3 and verse 6. 1 Timothy 3 and verse 6. Paul here is writing of the qualifications of a minister, and one of those qualifications is the minister, the potential minister, can't be new in the faith. It says they're not a novice, lest being lifted up with pride, he fall into the condemnation of the devil. That was the devil's sin. He was lifted up with pride. You remember? You remember what he said in Isaiah 14? 12 through 14, the 5 I wills, I will be like the Most High. That was his sin. Isaiah 14, 12 through 14. How art thou fallen from heaven, O Lucifer, son of the morning? How art thou cut down to the ground, which didst weaken the nations? For thou hast said in thine heart, I will ascend into heaven. I will exalt my throne above the stars of God. I will sit also upon the mount of the congregation in the sides of the north. I will ascend above the heights of the clouds. I will be like the Most High. That was his sin. He wanted to be like God. He thought so much of himself. He was so good that he thought that he should be God. I will be like God. He wanted to dethrone God. Didn't quite work out for him. Here's one of the reasons why he was proud. Look in Ezekiel 28 and verse 17. He was the greatest angel that God ever created. He was called the anointed cherub that covereth. He was that fifth cherub. He was beautiful. A lot of times, beauty will corrupt us. Most of us, some of us, I speak for myself, don't have to worry about that. But some people, anyway, it could corrupt you if you're beautiful. Ezekiel 28 and verse 17. Thine heart was lifted up because of thy beauty. Thou hast corrupted thy wisdom by reason of thy brightness. I will cast thee to the ground. I will lay thee before kings, that they may behold thee. He was lifted up because of his beauty. There God made him the most beautiful angel, probably the smartest, most powerful. I mean, he had it all, and it wasn't good enough, though. It wasn't enough. He still had to have that one other thing. He still had to be God. And as I think the book that you quoted to me the other day when Satan said, and this is fictional, but, you know, better to reign in hell than to serve in heaven. Is that the quote? Close to it? Yeah. Yep. Just not quite enough. He just had to have that last little bit, too. Now, pride is a sin. It was a sin for the devil, and it's a sin for you and I. Look in Mark 7 in verse 22. Mark 7 in verse 22. Jesus is speaking here of the sins that defile a man. And he says in verse 21, for from within, out of the heart of men, proceed evil thoughts, adulteries, fornications, murders, thefts, covetousness, wickedness, deceit, lasciviousness, an evil eye, blasphemy, pride, foolishness. All these evil things come from within and defile the man. You say, well, if I have a high opinion of myself, that's categorized with the same sins as fornication, adultery, murder, wickedness. Yeah, that is an evil thought that comes from the heart. That's probably a sin that a lot of people, that's one of the sins that a lot of people deal with, I assume, if my own experience is anything. Yeah, that's one that every one of us have to struggle with. Every one of us, I think, speaking for myself anyway, think that we're really something. And you really have to, from time to time, whenever you have those thoughts, just say, you know what, I am nothing. I am nothing. And you wouldn't be anything. Whatever you are, you wouldn't be if it wasn't for the Lord giving it to you. Myself included. It's one of those sins that you just hate. Everybody hates to see a proud person. Everybody hates pride in other people. And for some reason in yourself, it just doesn't seem all that hateful sometimes. I hate it in others, and I really hate it in myself. I hate it. Look at 2 Timothy 3 and verse 2. I've got a good quote, a couple good quotes. One really good one from Spurgeon here. I don't know if I'll get to it. Yeah, I think I will. Okay, I'll save it. 2 Timothy 3 and verse 2. Second Timothy 3:2. This is when Paul is speaking of the perilous times that shall come, and I would say that they're probably here, based on this list. He says, for men shall be lovers of their own selves. That's pride right there. Covetous, boasters, proud, blasphemers, disobedient to parents, unthankful, unholy, without natural affection, truce breakers, false accusers, incontinent, fierce, despisers of those that are good, traitors, heady, high-minded, lovers of pleasures, more than lovers of God, having the form of godliness, but denying the power of, from such, power thereof, from such turn away. Lovers of their own selves and proud. The church is supposed to turn away from such. That's an excludable offense if it's publicly known. Look at Romans 1 and verse 30. The beginning of this chapter, or the first part of this chapter, God talks about how there were Gentiles out there who just from the creation itself knew that there was a God, knew God's eternal power in Godhead so that they were without excuse. And they corrupted themselves with their fornication. They corrupted themselves with their sodomy. God gave them over to a reprobate mind in verse 28. And look at what they're filled with here. Verse 29, being filled with all unrighteousness, fornication, wickedness, covetousness, maliciousness, full of envy, murder, debate, deceit, malignity, whisperers, backbiters, haters of God, despiteful, proud, boasters, inventors of evil things, disobedient to parents. proud. Pride is lumped right in there once again with haters of God, of all things. The proud are lumped in there. Who here remembers what the sin of Sodom and Gomorrah was? It was pride, wasn't it? What do we normally think of when we think of Sodom and Gomorrah? We think of sodomy. That's where the name comes from Sodom. But actually, Sodom and Gomorrah's sins go, they precede the sodomy. Sodomy was just an outworking of other sins that were in their heart. We can read about that in Ezekiel 16 in verse 49. Ezekiel 16, 49. It says, "Behold, this was the iniquity of thy sister Sodom, pride." That's number one. Fullness of bread, there's the affluence. An abundance of idleness, there's what happens whenever you get affluent. You sit around and don't do anything. "Was in her and in her daughters, neither did she strengthen the hand of the poor and needy." She wasn't given to charity either. But the first sin there was pride. Sodom thought that they were such hot stuff. She said, no, that was Babylon, said in one place, "I am a queen and no other." You know, she thought Babylon was the same thing, proud. Thought that she was really hot stuff and God brought her down. The thing is about pride, God hates it. And so do most men, like I said, at least in other people. Some people don't hate their own if they're not Christians, but God hates it. Look in Proverbs 8 and verse 13. Proverbs 8 and verse 13. Jason, for you, that's on page 662. Get the same Bible as I do. Proverbs 8:13. It says, "The fear of the Lord is to hate evil, pride and arrogancy, and the evil way and the froward mouth do I hate." This is wisdom speaking here, and wisdom says, pride do I hate. Wisdom, which is God, which is Jesus Christ manifest in the flesh, he is the wisdom of God, he hates pride. Proverbs 16 and verse 5, just over a couple of pages, give us in the mouth of two witnesses here. But if the one witness was God, we really don't need two witnesses anyway. He can witness for himself. But anyway, Proverbs 16 and verse 5 says, "Everyone that is proud in heart is an abomination to the Lord. Though hand joined in hand, he shall not be unpunished." Abomination, if I remember correctly, is the combined disgust the combined feeling of disgust and hatred. So pride is something that disgusts God, makes him sick to his stomach, and he hates it. Both of which. God resists the proud, but he gives grace to the humble. Look at James 4 and verse 6. So if you want God to bless you, it's not by being proud, because when you're proud, God resists you. And I don't know about you, but I don't want the most powerful being in the universe resisting me. It's pretty hard to fight back against something like that. James 4 and verse 6 says, "But he giveth more grace. Wherefore he saith, God resisteth the proud, but giveth grace unto the humble." So if you want God to resist you, just go ahead and think highly of yourself. If you want God to help you and to give you grace and mercy, then be humble. And I will define humble here right now, as a matter of fact. Humble is having a low estimate of one's importance, worthiness or merits, marked by the absence of self-assertion or self-exaltation, lowly, the opposite of proud. If you remember the definition of proud, it was basically, just put a bar over this in logic, which means it's the complete opposite. To be proud is to have a high opinion, an estimate of yourself. To be humble is to have a low opinion of yourself. It's humility, not pride, that's the key to success. If you think about it, if you think fleshly, if you think carnally, you think, well, the successful person would be the person that really has a good perception of himself, really thinks that he is a good and a smart and a competent and a very accomplished individual. That's the guy that's going to be successful. He walks in there like he owns the place, and he's going to be successful. But the guy that doesn't think much of himself, well, he's not going to be successful. He doesn't think highly enough of himself. That's exactly the opposite, as a matter of fact. There's nothing wrong with being confident when you're right and so on. I mean, there's nothing wrong with that. But if you are one that really thinks that you are really hot stuff, that is not the key to success. And I got Bible for that. And I have some of the worldly wise men, which will attest to this as well. Look at James 4 and verse 10. It says, humble yourselves in the sight of God, or in the sight of the Lord, and he shall lift you up. You want to be exalted? You have to humble yourself. That's when you'll be successful, when you think lowly of yourself. Look at Proverbs 18 and verse 12. Proverbs 18 and verse 12. It says, before destruction, the heart of man is haughty, and before honor is humility. You want the honor, you have to be humble. First of all, that's when the honor comes. The humility must come first. Pride goeth before destruction, and then haughty spirit before a fall is another proverb. I don't know if that's 22:4 or not, but that's where we're going. 22:4. No, it's not. That was another one. I don't know where that one was. Proverbs 22:4 says, by humility and the fear of the Lord are riches and honor and life. You want to be promoted? It's by humility. God sees your humility. Even if your employer doesn't see it, God sees it, and he's the one that puts up one and sets down another. But men see it too. Men like humble people. We like to be around people that don't think so highly of themselves. People notice that. Humble, as in to humble yourself, the verb, is to render humble or meek in spirit, to cause to think more lowly of oneself. When God says, humble yourself in the sight of the Lord and he shall lift you up, think more lowly of yourself and God will lift you up. Humility is the quality of being humble, or having a lowly opinion of oneself. Meekness, lowliness, humbleness, the opposite of pride or haughtiness. This isn't just the word of God that says this. Here I have a quote here from an executive at Google, which is one of the biggest tech companies we all know out there. And if you work for Google, I mean, you've really attained to something. I mean, you put Google on your resume, you can pretty much work anywhere. I mean, that's a real honor in this world anyway, to work for Google. Well, WorldNet Daily, which is a news site, they interviewed Google Senior Vice President of Operations, Laszlo Bock, and found the following. And here's the quote from WorldNet Daily. It says, Bock cites a common error in, quote, successful people without intellectual humility. And this is what Bock says here. They, instead, commit the fundamental attribution error, which is, if something good happens, it's because I'm a genius. If something bad happens, it's because someone else is an idiot, or I didn't get the resources, or the market moved. You've met people like that. Something goes good, I'm such a genius, I'm so brilliant that this place couldn't run without me. Something bad happens, it's all, well, so-and-so blew it, so-and-so missed the mark, whatever. Something else happened, it couldn't be my fault. What we've seen is that the people who are the most successful here, who we want to hire, will have a fierce position. They'll argue like hell. They'll be zealots about their point of view. But then you say, here's a new fact, and they go, oh, well, that changes things. You're right. That's what one of the chief executives of Google says. That's the kind of people they're looking for. Like I said, it's not wrong to be confident in your position. If you think you're right, argue like you're right. But if somebody points to something and says, well, look at this, there's nothing wrong. In fact, it's the right thing to do to say, you know what? You're right. I was wrong. Thank you for correcting me. It works the same way with Bible doctrine. If I'm wrong, show me. Just show me. Point to the verse. Say, hey, Pastor, what about this verse? If I've missed it, I will freely admit that I'm wrong. He continues. He says, without humility, we are unable to learn, he said. I think he's a pretty wise guy for being a CEO of Google. Now, what one talks about tells you much about him. It says in Luke 6 and verse 45 that out of the abundance of the heart, the mouth speaketh. So whatever you talk about manifests what's in your heart. So when you hear somebody talking about themselves a lot, well, you know what's in their heart, themselves. That's what they're thinking about a lot. Turn to Matthew 6 and verse 21. This tells us that where our treasure is where our heart is. See what somebody values highest in their life. See what they spend the most money and time on, and you'll find where their heart is. That's all you have to do. Matthew 6 and verse 21, Jesus said, for where your treasure is, there will your heart be also. It says in Proverbs 23 and verse 7, as he thinketh in his heart, so is he. That's how you know what a person's like. What they're thinking in their heart, that defines who they are. And how do you know what they're thinking in their heart? It's because out of the abundance of the heart, the mouth speaketh. They'll tell you. So if one is posting voluminously about himself on Facebook, including about how wonderful his family is, how great his job is, how nice of things he has, the great vacation he went on, how interesting of a person he is, what does that tell you about what he thinks about the most? Himself. If you're posting about yourself constantly, well, that says that you think about yourself. That tells you a lot about a person. But the thing is, the Bible says that it's a fool that's only interested in himself. Proverbs 18 and verse 2. Proverbs 18 and verse 2. These things are easy to fall into. None of us are immune from it. Proverbs 18:2 says, a fool hath no delight in understanding, but that his heart may discover itself. He doesn't want to learn anything. He doesn't want to be taught anything. All he wants to do is find out about himself. He's just concerned about himself. Like I said, very easy to fall into pride. Even things that seem innocent might not be if they're done for the wrong reason. This could be making posts about your kids or about your job promotions, pictures of yourself, your house, your car, whatever. Think, oh, I just want to put it out there and just, you know, have everybody rejoice with them that rejoice. Well, maybe, maybe. That's okay. Rejoice with them that rejoice. But it just depends on your motives. It depends why you're putting that stuff out there. This is a call for introspection. Before you post anything on Facebook or Google Plus or LinkedIn, ask yourself why you're posting it. Why am I doing this? Is it to promote myself? Is it to make myself look good? Is it to impress other people? If that's the reason, don't post it. If you just simply want to share something that's going on in your life, and it's not to try to make yourself look good or get a bunch of likes or something, then that's okay. That's all right. But if you're doing it to impress people, don't do it. To search out your own glory is not good. Look at Proverbs 25 and verse 27. Proverbs 25, 27. It is not good to eat much honey, so for men to search their own glory is not glory. My old buddies Johnny and Matt had some good things to say about this. That's John Gill and Matthew Henry. I'm going to give you a couple quotes from them concern on this verse. John Gill said, to set forth their own excellencies, to sound forth their own praises, to seek honor of men, to use all methods to gain popular applause, this is not glorious and praiseworthy, but dishonorable. Couldn't agree more. Matthew Henry said, for men to search their own glory, to court applause, to covet, and covet to themselves, and covet to make themselves popular, is not their glory, but their shame. Everyone will laugh at them for it. And the glory which is so courted is not glory when it is got, for it is really no true honor to a man. Remember what Proverbs 27 and verse 2 says. It says, let another man praise thee, and not thine own mouth, a stranger, and not thine own lips. We need to let other people praise us. You don't need to praise yourself. You let others praise you. Now somebody's thinking, well, what if others don't praise me? I'll never get praised. Thank God. Thank God for that. That is something that will help you, not hurt you. Let other people do it. If it's really praiseworthy, others will see it and they will praise it. You don't need to promote yourself. And I'm speaking to myself. We don't need to promote ourselves. Let me put it that way. Here's a great quote from Charles Spurgeon in Lectures to My Students. This is a book that he wrote for potential ministers, ministers in training. Excellent, excellent book. You want to get a good window into the ministry, you read this book. I would recommend it. It's good. He said, we must also put away all notion of self-importance. God will not bless the man who thinks himself great. To glory even in the work of God the Holy Spirit in yourself is to tread dangerously near to self-adulation. Let another man praise thee and not thine own mouth, and be very glad when that other has sense enough to hold his tongue. So good. I think that quote probably sticks with me more than any other quote, and I think about it frequently. I think about it all the time. I don't mind it when you tell me, when you give me a compliment on the sermon, if you truly got something out of it, that's fine, but you don't have to. And as a matter of fact, I don't want you to do it very often. I mean, if you really, if something was like, wow, thank you, that was good, I never knew that, I didn't think of that, or well, that's okay. I mean, I don't care, and I don't mind if you talk to me about the sermon, that's fine. Don't think like you need to come up here every Sunday and say something good about the sermon. You don't need to do that. I used to, before I was ordained, I kind of judged how good the sermon was by how many people came up afterwards and said something. And back then, you know, it was kind of novel. You know, I wasn't the pastor, so it was somebody new, and people always come up and say, oh, that was great, blah, blah, blah. And then if people wouldn't say anything to me afterwards, I thought, oh, that must have been lousy. I've long since put that away, and I don't even think about it. Now if somebody says something to me about the sermon, I'm like, oh, okay, thanks. It's just kind of almost a surprise. I don't need that. Be very happy. How did he say it? Be very glad when the other has sense enough to hold his tongue. All that does is fill you with pride. It just blows up your ego, and you don't need that. But like I said, if you want to tell me that you're learning things or you're fed or something, that's fine. It is nice to at least know that you're getting something out of it. You know, the feedback is okay, but it doesn't certainly need to be excessive. Any wicked man can proclaim his own goodness, and most wicked men do, but we should not be so. Look in Proverbs 20 and verse 6. I can tell I'm definitely not going to get to the rest of this outline. That's all right. I'm almost done, so hang in there. Hang tight. I know it's hot and everything else. Proverbs 20 and verse 6. It says, most men will proclaim everyone his own goodness, but a faithful man who can find? It's not hard to find somebody out there that will tell you how good he is. Just go out there and talk to most anybody. He'll tell you what a great guy he is and how much he gives to charity or whatever, you know. He'll tell you all kinds of good things about him, how smart he is and how many great jobs he's had and how many toys he has and this, that, and the other thing. But a faithful man who can find, they're more rare. He that is wise in his own conceit, that is in his own mind, is a fool. Look at Proverbs 26 and verse 12. Proverbs 26 and verse 12 says, Seest thou a man wise in his own conceit? There is more hope of a fool than of him. You see a guy that in his own estimation, in his own mind, is a wise man. Yeah. You're not going to teach him anything. You know why? He knows it all already. There's more hope of a fool. If the fool can recognize that he's a fool, there's way more hope of a fool than of him. Try to talk to somebody that knows it all already. You're wasting your breath. Wasting your breath. I almost get to the point now in these YouTube debates, I haven't quite started doing it, but I almost feel like just responding and saying, I got a few questions for you. Do you want to know the truth? Could you be wrong? And if you were proven wrong, would you change your mind? And just start out every conversation with those three questions. If the answer is no to any of them, then go talk to somebody else. It's just a total waste of my time to talk to somebody that couldn't be wrong. I could be wrong. I answer yes to all three of those questions, absolutely. This goes not just for social networking sites, but for life in general. This whole idea of not of letting somebody else praise you. It's not he that commends himself which is approved, but it's whom God commends. That's whose praise you really want. That's who you really want to be commended by, is God, not other people. I mean, think about the people in this world and the people whom they commend and whom they praise. They're not good people, most of them. You know, what did Jesus say? Woe unto you when all men shall speak well of you. When people are saying good things, when everybody out there generally is saying good things about you, you're probably not in the right boat. You know, Jesus and his disciples get persecuted. People say all manner of evil against them for his sake. Not, when you have a preacher out there that the whole world loves, when he's America's pastor like Billy Graham, chances are he's not preaching the truth. I can tell you that much. Look at 2 Corinthians 10 and verse 18. 2 Corinthians 10 and verse 18. It says, for not he that commendeth himself is approved, but whom the Lord commendeth. That's what's important. If God commends you, that's good. You got that guy, I think it was in 2nd or 3rd John, where he said that he had a good report of them that are without and of the truth itself. When the truth itself gives you a good report, then that's then you're doing all right. It's to whom the Lord commendeth. Let me give you one more. This is not in the outline, but turn to Romans 2 and verse 29. You want to know if you're a Jew indeed, if you're a true spiritual Israelite? It's if your praise comes from God and not from men. Romans 2, 28, for he is not a Jew which is one outwardly, neither that circumcision which is outward in the flesh, but he is a Jew which is one inwardly. And circumcision is that of the heart, in the spirit, not in the letter, whose praise is not of men, but of God. That's who you want to praise you. You want God to praise you. If you get to the end of your life and you hear, well done, thou good and faithful servant, enter into the joy of thy Lord, it was all worth it. It doesn't matter if everybody down here thought that you were just worthless and stupid and completely unaccomplished. It doesn't matter. You hear God say, well done, thou good and faithful servant, then it's all worth it. Nobody likes to hear somebody else boast about themselves. Let me just give you a couple little points here and I'll be done. Relaying facts about yourself is not necessarily boasting. It just depends on what your motives are for sharing the information. So just simply saying, you know, I work at such and such a company is not boasting. You actually do work at that company. I mean, that's not wrong. But if you're saying, well, you know, I'm trying to do, I don't have a suit coat here, but anyway, you get my point. If your point is, I work at such and such a place, and that's a prestigious place, then you're boasting about it. Then you're doing it to get the praise of men. If you tell someone, something about yourself, such as what your profession is, or how much money you make, which is not wise, by the way, I wouldn't do that. Possessions you own or owned in the past, places you've been, jobs you've had, accomplishments you or your kids have made, etc. Just make sure that in your heart, you are sharing the information for godly purposes, such as edifying others, or building a relationship by sharing personal information. In order to build a relationship with somebody, you need to share personal information. If you never tell anybody anything personal about yourself, you're never going to have a close relationship. So to tell people things about yourself, things about your past, that's okay if you're doing it to build a relationship. But if in your heart you're doing it so that they will be impressed and that they will think that you're really something, then it's pride. Be careful to not allow pride to rear its ugly head and gloat about yourself by sharing information about yourself which randomly came up in a conversation, aka you intentionally dropped hints and feelers to elicit questions which you were all too eager to answer. We've all been there. You say just enough, you know, so that somebody will ask the question. You know, I, when I was overseas, I saw this thing and then, oh, you were overseas. Oh, yeah, let me tell you about that. Or whatever, you know. It's real easy. Oh, I didn't even mean to bring that up. You know, he just asked me about it. Yeah, right. You meant to bring it up. So anyway, be careful about that kind of thing. So that's what I have to say about pride. I was going to get into the tendency to say, share, and gossip way too much online, but I don't have time to finish that. So I will probably take that section of the outline and move it below the next section of the outline because I want to be able to cover the next section in one shot. And that's dealing with online pornography. And that's an extremely important one. So make sure you're here and ready to pay attention for that one. That will be next week, Lord willing. Thanks for listening. Thanks for your kind and patient attention on this muggy and hot summer day.